It's time to welcome our staff physicist into the studio. Aaron Wenger joins us now. Morning, Aaron.
Good morning to you.
Man, I'm surrounded by geniuses.
You know, I was...
Don't look at me, John.
I was listening to the weather bit as I was standing around, and you guys were talking about they've canceled the state something or other.
Cross-country ski meet.
Delayed it one day.
It was, you know, sort of a decent reason for it is that you can't shoot a gun when your fingers are numb. Mm-hmm. Come on. I don't think I've ever shot a deer that my fingers weren't stone cold numb. Give me a break.
Yeah, take my fingers out of my mouth and freeze them to the trigger. Oh, crap.
I tell you, the world certainly has gone soft.
Oh, man, it's terrible. God. When we were kids, we had to deer hunt naked.
Real men shot with their fingers numb. Anyhow.
Yeah, it's always fun. You know, that's one of the blessings of these gray beards that we carry. It's like, you know, we've accumulated a lot of mistakes. So we can speak smart. We can talk smart.
Oh, yeah, right, sure. I don't know about that even. I have to have my grandson come in sometime here in the next day or two when he has time. He has a very busy schedule, you know.
Grandkids do.
And hook up my new printer. I mean,
what happened to your old printer?
Well, this new printer, they don't run a USB or whatever cord anymore. That's passe. Now it's wireless. It just sits there. The only thing it's plugged into is, you know, electricity in the wall. The rest of it is some kind of strange communication going back and forth between the computer and the printer.
Wow.
And it requires, Judas Priest, password this and password that. And
I'm wondering, you're a physicist. What would happen if you stood in between the two? Is there like a stream of electrons that is going to cook part of your body?
Not electrons, but you can stand there. That's not going to matter.
Yeah.
Now, if you held
sure about that?
I'm positive about that. On the other hand, if you held a sheet of tin foil there, it might go away.
Oh, okay.
You know, so again, that's dating me. Tin foil? Yeah. There hasn't been tin foil since 1946 or something, but nonetheless.
Well, Aaron, you wanted to talk about the sky, right?
What is it going to do?
Sky,
oh, okay,
yeah,
it's coming back to me now.
That's what you call it, Orion.
This time of year is about as good as it gets. For looking at the winter constellations.
Yes.
And I think a lot of folks who listen to this probably can find Orion. And say, you know, 9 o'clock tonight, it'll be over there, almost due south in your sky.
Yep.
And something like 35 or 40 degrees up.
Right.
And if you visualize Orion in your mind's eye, it looks like two not real bright, but reasonably bright stars making the shoulders of Orion. And then it pinches down like a bodybuilder, man, to a tight little waist, and then flares out to two legs or knees or whatever you want to call it. And towards the west is this curved line of fairly faint stars, the shield stars of Orion. That top, as we look at it, left shoulder star is Betelgeuse. And...
One second. For those who aren't really familiar, the one defining feature of this asterism is the belt, the three stars in the middle that really make it leap out at you. That's the one thing that if you know nothing about the sky, if you look south tonight at 9 o'clock on a clear night and you look up above the horizon at, say, 35 or 40 degrees, you're going to see three stars in a row. And that's the belt of Orion. Up to the upper left.
That'd be towards the east.
East, right.
That belt of stars isn't horizontal. Don't confuse it with being straight with respect to the horizon. It'll be angled up and to the right a little bit. That's the belt of Orion. And there's actually an even fainter line of stars that hang, if you want, from the left edge of that belt, which is the sword of Orion.
Right, right.
And that's those of you who fool around with binoculars or a telescope or something, in that sword of Orion is where the Orion Nebula is. Now, all that to us, when you're standing here looking at it, looks like, well, that's like it was drawn on a piece of paper. It looks like it's all the same. Well, of course, it's not. The Orion Nebula is only about 580, something like that, light years from us. The star that I'm talking about, Betelgeuse, the upper left shoulder star, is about 1,500 or 1,600 light years from us.
Another 1,000 light years further away, roughly.
You're looking at a three-dimensional structure, and we see it in a two-dimensional plane, That star, Betelgeuse, is an interesting one. All of my lifetime, Orion's a favorite constellation, one of the first constellations probably I knew besides Big and Little Dipper.
Right.
But all of my lifetime, that bright star, Betelgeuse, was a bright red star. And it really equaled, or close to, equaled in brightness, the star down in the right leg of Orion, which is Rigel, which is the brightest star in that constellation as seen by us. They were about of equal brightness. Rigel's a blue star, Betelgeuse, even to your eye, certainly through a pair of binoculars, a red, reddish star. It's been fading for the last, 2 years on and off. It's not a steady fade. It stops for a while, and then it gets maybe a little brighter, and then it gets a little dimmer, but the overall trend has been fading. And as of now, you look at that constellation in Betelgeuse, it's really no brighter, or only barely, than the star in the right-hand shoulder, which means it's relatively dim now. The best models, well, first of all, I got to say this. People always think about if you think of it all, of stars taking billions or hundreds of millions of years or something to go through any significant change. That's true for a star like the Sun. Billion years doesn't mean a whole lot to a star like the Sun. But when you get bigger stars, more massive, it all depends on mass. It's the only thing that it depends upon. When you have more massive stars than the Sun, and Betelgeuse is one of them, then they go through their evolutionary sequence of burning different fuels in tens of millions of years, even less. And Betelgeuse is a red giant star. It's a star that evolved, burned different mixtures, hydrogen, helium to carbon, and so on, in its furnace, in its core, and has moved years, tens of thousands of years ago, into what we call a red giant star. Red giant stars age pretty quickly, at least massive ones. And the thing that it's probably going to do at the end of its period in being a red giant is go nova or supernova. In the case of a star like Betelgeuse, it'd be a good bet, if you were a betting person, that it would go supernova. When that happens, the star blows up. There'll be a core left behind that turns into a neutron star and some stuff. But that whole star system, the planets that are around it, etc., is going to go away.
not technically going away. Just going to be reduced to smaller parts.
It's going to be, the core that'll get left behind will still be more massive than our star.
Wow.
But it'll be the size of, say, Texas, something like that. it becomes a star with not any atoms any longer, no nuclei of atoms any longer. The protons and neutrons all shift into being just neutrons, neutral particles, so that they can pack in tighter, get denser. But in the doing of that, in a relatively short period of time, the star, the usual way of saying, sheds its outer layers. Well, it doesn't shed them exactly.
Yeah.
It's a big bang.
Yeah.
And the last one that was in the news and that people in physics paid a lot of attention to was back in 1987. And that was in a small galaxy that surrounds ours, one of the dwarf galaxies that orbit our galaxy. So it was on the order of hundreds of thousands of years, light years away, or hundred thousands of years in time. And in that explosion, a small telescope, 10-inch or something, would have allowed you to see a star that you would never have seen before. It was the exploding star that was going supernova. It's in those supernova explosions that the gold in your ring got made and things like that. In Betelgeuse's case, if we were so lucky... I mean, son of a gun, I'd pay a lot of money, well, what money I had, to be this lucky. If it happened, go in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, I got to back that up. That means that it would have gone something on the order of 1,500 years ago,
right,
because it's that many light years,
right,
away.
Because the light is just getting to us.
Yeah. That means it would have kind of gone at the time of Galileo, but the light's just getting here now. Something like, well, no, even worse than Galileo, the second dynasty in Egypt. That's when it would have gone. But if you were so lucky, I think even on the kind of crummy overcast skies that we've had all winter long, I think you'd see it as a dim moon in our nighttime sky.
Seriously, that bright?
Yeah.
Wow.
They increase their energy output by 100,000 fold or something.
Oh, man.
And it doesn't, the one in 1987, people
tracked. Was that Southern Hemisphere? Is that?
Yeah, that yeah, was.
That's
that was.
What I thought.
People tracked that with instrumentation for 4 or 5 years, mm-hmm. put it that way. You still can. We were interested in it because it was our first relatively close supernova in the age of instrumentation. People have seen other supernova, 1054 AD, Chinese recorded one, and so on, but never with modern instrumentation. And so there's a lot of attention paid to it over a decade or something like that. This one would be astounding. I mean, that's practically next door.
Now, when Betelgeuse goes supernova, will it be, is it one of those things where you better be looking today because tomorrow it's going to be gone?
No. That'll persist for, this is a non-educated guess.
Right.
Months.
Okay.
Years.
So they don't need to have like a telescope trained on
absolutely
the star.
Not.
Once it begins to happen, they will notice and they will subsequently point their equipment
there's
at it.
There's probably a whole bunch of PhD candidates out there right now monitoring Betelgeuse in fairly sophisticated ways every night.
Uh-huh.
But we don't have that good a model to be able to predict when a star like Betelgeuse would actually make the transition into being supernova. We pretty darn sure of some leading events that would give us notice that it's happening.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not that a complete a model that you can do. People have understood the general physics of what goes on in a star as it ages, as it goes through its evolutionary sequence for 50 years or more. And the models get more detailed and more detailed. But after all, if all that you had sitting out here in the yard was 10 pounds of dynamite, I wouldn't be able to model very successfully for you the details of what goes on when you touch it off. Where this jet goes, how fast the temperature ball of the explosion expands, I wouldn't be able to model that perfectly. The thermal dynamics or the fluid dynamics of something like that exploding is beyond modeling at this point. And for a star, amazingly, it's somewhat simpler because you have an almost perfectly spherical object with a lot of mixing going on. There's a lot of averaging out that you can do of what goes on in this collapse of the core and the rapid expansion of the overlaying layers of a star during a nova supernova explosion. One of the interesting things is the 1987 one. It must have been in 1988 or 89. I was down to one of the Nobel conferences that Gustavus Adolphus holds, and they had Professor Fowler there of Burbage, Fowler, and Hoyle fame. And this was the first.
Who doesn't know them?
Yeah, who doesn't know them? They are the team of people who, with a fair amount of detail for the time, figured out the nucleosynthesis progression of element formation in a star.
Ooh.
And one of the things that they couldn't adequately predict at that time, but were pretty certain of, is that in a supernova, because of all the neutrons that are released, it's like a high-energy accelerator, that you should get a process of like neutron addition to simpler nuclei. stars make everything up into, including iron. Beyond that, in the normal course of their evolution, they make everything up to and including iron. Beyond that, to get the heavier metals, the heavier stuff, the uraniums, the silver, the golds, and so on, that has to be made in sort of the furnace of either nova or supernova explosion.
Everything on the periodic chart that is a metal or
an heavier beyond
heavier
iron.
Than iron, which is what, 26? Is that
number I remember is 56.
56. Yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah, I knew there. Yeah. All right. Wow. So half of the periodic chart, more than half now.
But again, keep in mind how. Almost all of the periodic chart is in the first dozen elements.
Right, right.
They get successively rarer and once past iron, because you only get perhaps a supernova in a whole galaxy maybe every 100 years or something like that, in this epoch of the galaxy anyhow. The stuff that then gets booted out into the interstellar medium is extraordinarily rare in the heavier elements. So
just to satisfy my own curiosity, all the gold on Earth was created by stars, all came to us from stardust, and accumulated.
Well, it came to us in the
None of it was created here on Earth.
Absolutely not. All of that stuff was present at the time of the formation of this star and subsequently these planets around.
These planets, right.
It forms a sort of background medium out of which later generations of stars form. Up there in the Orion Nebula right now, stars in the process of formation, the material that they have to work with has been already enriched in this galaxy by 4 or 5 previous generations of more massive stars making this stuff. That's how it works.
Wow.
The carbon, all organic chemistry, that came from a star like Orion, who for the past however millions of years has been, burning helium to make carbon in its core. And that process is really accelerated. When carbon fuses, it gives off so much more energy than helium does, and that's what's going to drive the explosion of Betelgeuse's outer layers into the
carbon.
Supernova thing. Yeah, carbon fuses, the fusion of carbon.
Fusion of carbon, right.
Yep.
So as a question, what would be the time scale before, say, the sun would get to that stage? And
this is a rinky-dink star. In terms of mass.
Our sun.
Yeah, which is good. I suspect any place that creatures are ever having a conversation like this is around a star like the sun or less massive, because that's the only ones that give you billions of years of relatively stable operation.
Mm-hmm.
This star has been doing this for basically what it's doing now for 3.5 or 4 billion years, and it's going to do basically what it's doing now for a couple more billion years at least. And it's in that time that you can get the chemical evolution into big organic and complex molecules and eventually get something called life. So it requires that kind of star. A star like Orion, I don't remember exactly, but 4 times perhaps, something like that, 4 or 6 times as massive as the sun. It goes through that sequence of fusion processes in its core, evolution. It goes through that set of sequences in 10 million, 20 million, perhaps 100 million years.
And back to Betelgeuse, we don't know when that, it's already been a supernova.
No, not Betelgeuse. It has never been a supernova.
Isn't that light coming to us now? I mean,
because of the time lag. It may have already.
In which case, it could be here tomorrow, or it could be here 1.5 light years from tomorrow.
People have learned to deal with that, and they're thinking about it and speaking about it for a long time now. When 1968, 1969, when the so-called race for the moon was going on. And at first glance, it appeared that the Russians had the right idea. have someone with whatever joysticks. That's not how it would be, but have someone on the ground controlling the space flight, the spacecraft as it lands on the moon. Of course, that seems to be reasonable. But there was about a second delay, a half a second for the spacecraft to send back information saying, "I'm heading towards a mountain."
Yeah.
And if the computer or the person on Earth immediately responded, turn left, yeah, another four half second yeah, for it to get there, and that means it's already dug a hole.
Yeah.
And in the case of something like interstellar distances, it gets a little better. And then you have to sort of talk about events in human history.
Yeah. So we could see this supernova in Betelgeuse, or we might not. It might be our grandkids.
Yeah. I'd like it to be in my life. Yeah. That would be something
yeah,
else.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm enough of a greedy guy to say, let it happen now. Let me see it.
Yeah. I mean, it would be perhaps truly spectacular in the sense of a nearly full moon object, bright object, wow, in the sky.
Yeah. Yeah.
Two full moons. You know, if a full moon plus Betelgeuse.
And the one moon changing from night to night. I mean, the supernova explosion, once initiated, the inside processes of that are changing quickly, reasonably quickly.
No.
That's Aaron Wenger, our staff physicist, along with staff phenologist John Latimer, our staff weatherman, Tornado Bob.
Whoa.
Thanks so much for tuning in this Tuesday. Come back again soon, Aaron.
Please do, yeah. Enjoyed this.